start this second lecture, which is a tutorial on a different subject. Nothing to do explicitly with electrostatics, although, as some of you have already noted, that many biological membranes are charged, but we're going to ignore the charges for the moment and talk about membrane physics. Okay. And I know you've had a lot about membranes, but I want to sort of bring everybody up to speed to make sure we understand how we think of them. So here's a typical kind of cartoon that you see of a part of a cell wall. Here's sort of the cytoskeleton stuff, the spectrum network, and you have all these transmembrane proteins and glycolipids and all other kinds of stuff. And being what standard thing that physicists do is to get rid of all the complicated stuff. In this case, it means all of the protein in this picture, all the colored stuff, and talk about the black stuff, the membrane. The black stuff, which is the wall separating the inside and the outside of cells, and that's, in some sense, the principal role of membranes is to compartmentalize things. Okay. Now, if you want to understand biological membranes, whether they're cell walls or nuclei walls or whatever, you're going to have to understand, again, the role of all of the proteins and other stuff, and carbon, polysaccharides, or whatever else you have. But the membrane itself plays a role. And so it's useful to understand some of the properties of membranes because people often think about them incorrectly. Okay, so I want to say something about the membrane, and that is, at this point, and I think in everything that I'll be able to say in an hour, I'm not going to have any of the colored stuff, or even the spectrum network, the stuff at the bottom. Okay, and that's all very important, and those are the kind of problems that people who work on physics of membranes are working on nowadays.
I'll just tell you, I did a presentation this morning where I showed, and you're familiar with these, all of the work I did with Evan, so that the audience has already seen the videos of membranes undulating, bending stiffness, elastic modulus.
Okay, so, so I'm going to give them the flavor of that from the physics viewpoint.
Yeah.
Same thing.
Perfect.
What David said is precisely what I wanted to tell you about. So I'm only going to talk about the membranes. I'm not going to show you any movies or anything, but I'm going to give you a physics way of trying to rationalize a lot of the properties. I might show you some results. Okay. So the first thing that's important to understand about membranes, and I'll do most of it on the board again, but I'll show you the pictures at the beginning, is that they're self-assembling, and that's crucial. As I'm sure David told you, the membranes are made of these phospholipids, at least for the biological membranes are made of phospholipids, which are not drawn properly here. But so a phospholipid basically has some kind of polar head. Using the jargon, it's a polar head. And typically, two alkyl tails. If it only has one tail, then it's called a detergent. The detergents sort of do the same thing as phospholipids, but the numbers are a little different. Okay. Nature uses these ones with two tails called phospholipids. The tails are just CH2s, and there may be, let's say, 20. Just to give the scales correct on each chain. And so therefore, it's just a hydrocarbon, perfectly hydrophobic. They don't like water at all. And then the head, by nature, I told you, it's polar, called a polar head, is something that typically likes water. It's either something that's ionizable, or it has something like a polyethylene glycol piece to it. Some reason, and therefore, a hydrogen bond with water, something that likes water. Okay. So So that means these kind of molecules, these so-called surfactant molecules, are schizophrenic. Okay, and it's that schizophrenia that gives them all their properties. Okay, and until about, let's say, a year ago, there were essentially people couldn't simulate membranes. Everybody understood what happened, that they held together because if they formed this kind of bilayer structure with the black stuff being these polar heads and the white stuff being the hydrocarbon tails, that this way the water is excluded from the inside, so the hydrocarbons don't see water and the heads see the water and happy. This is a way of hiding a structure that could self-assemble that makes everybody happy. Of course, there are other structures that do that too. They could form spheres or cylinders, and sometimes they do. When they do, then we don't call them membranes. We call them micelles or cylindrical micelles or something else. And that depends on the details, what they form, okay. But here we're only interested in membranes, so we're only interested in those guys that form cells, okay. Now, as I say, until something of the scale of a year or two ago, there was a lot of understanding of membranes, but no numerical simulations. No simulations in the sense where people put in molecules, let's say toy molecules that look like that, and put them into their computer, and then they come together and form a membrane. Okay. People did a lot of work on simulating the membranes. I just stepped in my shoelace, and I'm tired, so I'll tie it while I'm talking. And those simulations did not involve self-assembly. But the self-assembly part is important. So if you don't do the self-assembly, and there are a lot of work by people who looked at membranes like a tennis net, okay, that work is interesting and good, but it leaves out, and this is a lot of the physics because it doesn't, they're not self-assembled. So a lot of that work is pretty old. So that stuff is gone. So until, as I say, about a year ago, but nowadays, this is a result of a simulation that's a couple of years old by Oded Farago, who's a young Israeli simulator who's at the Ben Gurion University now, and there are many others like that. Okay, so now we know that these things come together, and you know why? Because they shield the hydrocarbons from the water. But how that works is important. So let me tell you how to do it. And the nice way of doing it was pointed out again somehow in the early part of this of the 20th century by Schumann. And I think this is the way you should think about it. That's not the picture that I want to see. So here's our membrane. This is what the membrane looks like. And there's a certain parameters. There's the thickness of the membrane, which I'm calling here delta or 2 delta, and then there's the distance between the heads. Okay. Now the way Schumann told us to think about it, and I like it because it's so simple, it's very nice, is that you should think of the inside of the membrane as just a melted oil, like an oil film. Because after all, the hydrophobic interaction, the fact that oil hates the water is so strong, there's not going to be any water in there. It's going to be a little bit, but it's essentially zero water in there. So he said, think of this as like a paraffin, like a hydrocarbon melt. And then there are only a few structural parameters. There's the area per head, which I call sigma, and there's the thickness. But there's a constraint, because if the inside is a melt, as Silman suggested, as it should be in a good approximation, then sigma times delta is the volume occupied by one of these phospholipids. I'm pushing under the rug whether there's one or two tails, because I mean this is all, you could put in twos and stuff if you want to, I don't care about that. It is a constant. So there's a constraint. So that means if the area per head is bigger, if the heads are farther apart, then the film is thinner. And that's absolutely crucial in many cases. When you do something to perturb something, like pulling the heads apart, as you do when you insert a molecule, the thickness is going to change locally. You've got to remember that. Okay. So that's important. What can you say about this? So now let's do a little physics with this. Let's write down, as I like to do, the free energy in this picture. So let's say that I want to be careful about extensivity. So S is the total area of my membrane. N is the number of surfactants. And I'm putting N surfactants, I'm taking a few grams of surfactant, dissolving them in water, and that they all form a membrane. I'm going to assume that the surfactants are absolutely insoluble in the water. In fact, there's always a little solubility, but it's small. And therefore, I'm going to write down the free energy of the membrane as two terms. So the free energy has two, I can write it in the following way. I can write a term that's proportional to the area. So the proportionality constant is the surface tension. That's because the surface tension is the free energy per unit area of the surface. And that's essentially, I have this oil, this water, this oil film in contact with oil. So this surface tension, I should think of here as the surface tension of the oil-water interface, which we know, it's always 50 dynes per centimeter, independent of what oil it is, give or take a few percent, okay? That's easy to see. And then there's the heads. So there's the heads interact with some interaction. I'll call it the heads repel one another. They have to repel one another. And some unknown form, but it's certainly a function of the area per head, and it multiplied by S. Okay.
What about tail?
Well, that's included. But the tail, I'm already told you it's a hydrocarbon melt. This is a melt, so molds, I'll take that away, zero is energy. Okay, so now, and I have the constraint, what I said before, that the surfactants are insoluble, that the surface area is the number of surfactants times the area per surfactant. Just doing simple bookkeeping. Okay, so now we just insert this in here, and then you minimize the free energy with respect to what you don't know, which is sigma, for a fixed N. That's always what you do, as Schumann did. And you, there it is, and you get this equation. So this equation, whether this equation has a solution for sigma, depends on G. On this G of sigma, whatever it is that describes all the interactions in the problem. If it doesn't have a solution, then I don't have membranes, no big deal. If it has a solution, then I get membranes. And in fact, in all of the obvious cases, you have a solution. Okay. Now the important thing is, if there's a solution to this equation, and I can give you some examples of G in a minute, then this is equivalent to saying that the surface tension of my object, the net surface tension of the whole thing together, not gamma, but gamma effective, is zero. Okay, so the first lesson you learn here is that the self-assembling membranes have zero surface tension. At this level, no surface tension. Okay, and that's immediate when you think about it this way. Okay, so there's no surface tension in these membranes. And let me say a few things about.
But can you just ever, Mr. Fuso? That would mean that they have no preference of being in the heads, for example, no preference.
No, they're all in the membrane, but surface. Okay.
So which tension was it?
It means that. If they were bent into a vesicle, there would be no pressure difference. It's just completely floppy.
There's no tension in the surface. Yeah.
There's no tension. There's no elasticity.
It's different for the surface tension.
So surface tension. Okay, you want to think about surface tension as the energy to add more surface area. You can't, then it's obvious that there's no surface tension because I already told you the surfactants are insoluble.
Right.
So there's no surface tension.
Right,
that's the other way of seeing it. But they're equivalent. Those statements are equivalent. So there's no surface tension. Now that's an approximation. It's an approximation because I've assumed this is flat at the beginning, okay? But that's because I'm doing the lowest order part of the problem, okay? Now, maybe I should say a couple of words about, just to show you what G's are. Just so it's not mysterious. One piece of G has a membrane with its tails. I'll just draw these single tails like that. A thickness something like 2 delta. Okay, one piece is the following. We've assumed that inside it's molten tail. But to achieve that, if I think, these tails are a little bit like polymers. And a polymer elasticity. So if these were polymers, then you would say to achieve that picture, the tails have to be stretched so that they go from here to there, so that there's no empty volume, because there can't be any volume in here. There can't be, otherwise it would be filled by water. So there's a certain stretching energy to do that. And that stretching energy is just polymer elasticity. If n is the number of CH2 groups on this thing, then there's an elastic energy, which is KT delta squared over M A squared, where A is something like the size of a CH2 group, that's a couple of angstroms. That would be the elastic energy per chain to stretch, and it would be this multiplied by the, well, okay, that's the elastic energy per chain, and that would be a contribution to G. Because it depends on sigma, because remember, delta sigma is a constant. So this goes as 1 over sigma squared. So this says there's a G that goes as 1 over sigma squared, which is repulsive. That's one contribution. These guys may be charged, and there is a repulsion term. There's another contribution, and I could have got that from my last lecture, and then it's something that goes as a logarithm. Or there's if the head group has to be a polyethylene glycol chain, then these things form a polymer brush, and there's a repulsive energy between them because they're in a good solvent, which is water, and then they're also stretched. So we get, there's a lot of ways we can calculate G, and all those ways give you a G which could minimize this energy. So there's no problem. There's no mystery for that. But all of the physics in the problem, in some sense, is what's in this G function. Okay. So we'll come back to that in a minute.
G prime is necessarily
G prime is a derivative.
Necessarily negative.
G prime is necessarily negative.
Yeah.
And as you saw, it is.
Yeah, right.
Well, there's one contribution which actually gives rise to traction. I mean, if you pull the membrane, if you make sigma bigger and bigger, you're exposing hydrophobic material to the solvent.
Well, that's right, but that's what's built into you. That's automatically built in when you say that the inside has to be a melt. Just think about it for a minute. You'll see. It's already built in.
It's built in also
when you make that Shulman approximation. Okay. So this is the self-assembly process in the simplest way. Now, in this kind of picture, I'm pushing, in some sense, a lot under the rug, because not that this is wrong, but if you want to do this in a simulation, it's extraordinarily difficult for many reasons, because the main reason is that in the membrane, you have a membrane plus you have the water. In any realistic simulation of a big system, you can't include the water. So the water is replaced by a continuum, but the water plays a crucial role. So it's very difficult to simulate the self-assembly without putting in the water. And that's why it's only been in the last year or two that people have been clever enough to put in hokey potentials which simulate the effect of water. Okay. And get those pictures of the kind I showed you. Okay, now, Okay, so now we know that these membranes, oh, by the way, from this you already learned a lot of stuff. That the energy scale of the problem is fixed by the oil-water surface tension. It's 50 dynes per centimeter. Okay, so you already know the energy scale. Okay, and that energy scale, by the way, is KT. The surface tension is an energy per unit area. The energy is roughly is KT, because that's what controls everything, and the length scale is the size of a surfactant. The size of a surfactant is about delta. You see that here. So T over delta squared is something like this 50 dynes per centimeter. Okay, and that's about right. Okay, now what about the shape? Here we've assumed it flat, but of course the membranes could have different shapes. It's like a sheet of paper. But a membrane is not like a sheet of paper, so I shouldn't have said that. Don't think of it as a sheet of paper, because a sheet of paper is not self-assembled. Sheet of paper has a fixed metric. Membranes do not, okay? Membranes could adjust. That's the crucial thing which people seem to forget. They do a membrane and they think of it like a piece of paper. It's not, okay? So if you do something locally, the thickness of the membrane is going to change, the area of bread is going to change. It's not a sheet of paper. Okay. Now,
would you even think of it as an elastic sheet?
Huh?
Would you think of it as an elastic sheet?
No, it's a liquid sheet. It's a fluid sheet.
Two-dimensional
fluid. Yeah. Oh, by the way, in the regime where most biology works, these are not ordered. This is a fluid. If you cool these membranes, they go into what's, I hate that jargon, they call it a gel. It's nothing to do with a gel, but it's an ordered, like a crystalline phase in this tail. That doesn't seem to be biologically relevant as far as I know. But so everything that we're talking about is this inside, you think of it as just like oil. But it's a two-dimensional oil sheet. Okay, now what about the shapes? So we have this membrane and it could form different shapes. It could bend. So we want to understand a little bit of this geometry, this mathematics geometry, and describe it about the shape. So I stole this from somebody, I forgot who it was now, some guy on the internet stole this picture without a reference. And actually, I know the guy who did this, but I forgot his name. So for a surface, this is just, again, first year analytic geometry or something. If I have a surface, so a surface means a two-dimensional object and that lives in three space and could bend, at any local point in space, there are two curvatures, because I could do two orthogonal axes. I could bend along the x-axis or along the y-axis or whatever orthogonal axis I want to call it then. And those two curvatures here are called C1 and C2. So there's two parameters for a curved surface at any point in space. A lot of you guys are mathematicians, so you know this better than I. And it's convenient in these kinds of problems to define these two. So I have two parameters. I could mix and match any way I want. It's convenient to define the mean curvature at any point. This is a function of where you are in space, which is half the sum. And the Gaussian curvature, which is the product. Again, this is crappy notation, because these two guys have different units. This is units of 1 over a length squared. 1 over a length, and this has a 1 over a length squared. So they have different units. But that's the way people do it, so we have to live with it. Okay. The Gaussian curvature has to do with saddle space. Now, so in terms of writing, in terms of physics, you want to write down energies associated with what it does to take our membrane and deform it in this way. And there are two. So you want it to the total free energy you have to integrate over the surface of the area of the membrane. And one term, this is what it is, and then we'll talk a little bit about it, is what's called the bending energy, which is h squared. Notice, so kappa, the parameter here is called the bending energy, because this is a constant. but it has dimensions of an energy, because H is 1 over a length, so this is 1 over a length squared, that's a length squared, so this is an energy. And guess what energy it is, typically? KT, it's only KT. If it's not KT, it's no interest to biology. By the way, that's why biology uses lipid membranes, phospholipids. If it, you could make membranes out of polymers, big long things, but then the energy goes up something like the cube of the number of monomers in the chain. So you very quickly get up to energies that are 1,000 KT, and you're not interested in it anymore. Nothing. So biology, that's why biology uses lipids. Okay, this energy is KT. And this one is the Gaussian curvature, so I only have that linear because that also is 1 over r squared. And that coefficient, I mean, at this level, it's an independent parameter. But recall, these are not independent parameters. I'm only doing it because I'm writing it down, like a mathematician would write it down. But this comes from the same physics that I showed you in the last slide. So these kappa and kappa g are completely governed by this g at gamma that I told you before. Okay. So then there's no new physics in there. This is the energy. And the way, okay, so that's... So that's the lowest order. Now I'm gonna let me say something else. Okay, so what? What I'm thinking, the way you want to think about this is the following. I want to write down the free energy of the membrane, and I want to start with the flat membrane. Okay. So I'm gonna write down the free energy, which is a function of sigma, the area per head. I only have one, because if I know sigma, I know delta, okay. And then I have, if the membrane is bent, then I have these two things I call the mean curvature and the Gaussian curvature, which we call it K. And I'm gonna write that in a kind of Taylor series expansion. I'm gonna write it as F0 of the flat membrane, that's the one I just did, that was the Strowman construction, plus then I have F1 something, H where that involves some derivative here, plus a half F2 H squared, plus similar thing, I don't know, we'll call it bar, kappa, etc. So I'm thinking of a Taylor series expansion of a weakly bent membrane. In other words, what I'm doing, in some sense, is a expansion in a small parameter. If here's my membrane of thickness delta, really, and it's bending on a radius of curvature r, I'm doing, this is an expansion in powers of delta over r. So I'm assuming I have a weak curvature. That's what I'm doing. So taking the shape of my membrane and expanding it in this kind of Taylor series. Now, and then I can write these corrections because it depends. There are two local radii of curvature. There's R1 and R2, which I called C1 and C2 before. They're going to be different kinds of terms, you know, where I mix and match them, and I can write them in this form. But the important thing to realize is that this expansion here is nothing but something that looks like the following way. As this F0, which is the flat surface, plus some constant alpha1 terms that are linear in H over R, and I'll just call H over R. There's two terms, one for R1 and one for R2. And then terms like alpha2 that go as H over R squared. And now there are, you know, three terms, depending on R1 and R2. I'm just doing something that's better. It's symbolic. The first thing to note is that if the membrane is symmetric, which in In biology, it often is not, because there's an inside and an outside. But let me assume that there is, just to make life simple. Then, in this term, is zero lysimmetry. There can't be anything that depends on the sign of R, whether R is positive or negative. Right? Because they're symmetric. So the lowest order terms are in R and H squared, or capital. And that's why this is for symmetric membranes. Okay?
That's a delta.
H is delta. I'm sorry. Sorry, guys. Okay. Okay, so that's why there's this canonical form for the Bentley energy. And you should think of it as the first terms in a power series expansion in bending a very thin membrane. So this is not good for when the radius of curvature is comparable to the membrane thickness. And then you would have to go to higher order terms. Now, just to remind you back to these number business, so the bending energy is kappa, and again, there's two of them, kappa and kappa g, but at this level, they're indistinguishable. How bigger? Remember, their units are energies. So that means they have to be of order gamma, that's an energy per unit area, times delta squared. So kappa and kappa g are of the order of kT. And when I say of the order of kT, for real phospholipid membranes, the number is around 20.
Why not choose a scaling based on g, the interaction, and not gamma?
Because people don't know that. You don't know that. There are many contributions to the interaction. There's not one interaction. I listed three or four of them already. So it's a combination, and every membrane is different. So in practice, what people describe the membranes by knowing kappa in principle and kappa g. By the way, kappa g is very difficult to measure. There's maybe, as far as I know, there may be one, maybe two measurements of kappa g. It's a very awkward thing to measure. I'll tell you why in a minute. But as far as we know, it's it's comparable to kappa.
Can you give a pointer from the measurement?
Who did it?
Yeah.
It was a long time ago, I can't remember. Do you guys remember?
No.
I don't remember, but there are a few measurements. I mean, it's very tricky to do because kappa G involves topological changes. In fact, I didn't tell you that, so let me tell you that right now. For most of the things we're interested in, for membranes, without topological changes, we don't have to worry about kappa g. So that's the Gauss. I spent a lot of time talking about Gauss's theorem before. Gauss's theorem appears here too. It's the same Gauss. It's essentially the same theorem. In this case, it's called the Gauss-Bonnet theorem, but it's just saying the same thing as Gauss's theorem before in different words. And what the theorem says is that the integral. Should be K, what I call K, the Gaussian curvature, the thing I call K, the Gaussian curvature, over any closed surface is 2 pi times an integer, which has some name, which I forgot what it's called. Oh, it's called the Euler characteristic. I forgot what it is. Just a number. Basically, what that number is the number of holes in the surface. Or handles, as a topologist call it. It's the number of holes in the surface. Okay. So a sphere as that constant is zero, I think. Okay, so it doesn't measure the number of holes. But it's independent of a sphere and an ellipsoid are all the same thing. It's independent of the shape of the subject. It only depends on the number of holes. So if we're interested in changing membranes, but not changing the topology, not poking in new holes and stuff. Now, holes are interesting when you start to think about pores and things like that. But as long as we don't put in new holes, and we're only speaking at this kind of continuum level, remember this is all continuum stuff, then because this is a constant, we could absolutely ignore kappa G. Because remember, the only place the Kg, that the Gaussian bending constant appears is in this term, but this term is just a number. This is what I said is a number, is 2 pi times an integer. So it's a constant, it doesn't change, so it doesn't affect anything. So most of the time, for most cases, the only thing we care about is this one. And that's why it's written in this parameterization. So you could make use of this Gauss-Bonnet theorem. Which is just mathematics, by the way, there's no physics.
This gamma delta squared, can you explain a little bit why the delta squared again?
Well, the easiest thing is just by dimensional analysis.
Right,
kappa has to be an energy. The only length of the problem is delta. So what else could it be? You got another length? There aren't any other relevant lengths. That's what makes this kind of stuff easy. Because you don't have a variety of lengths. So, of course, I don't know the number. But you can do that. People have done that. I mean, you have to make a toy model, and actually calculate it. There's a group in Bulgaria that are very good at doing that, that know how to do these take these models with, tails and bend it and actually do all the geometry, calculate these things, you can do it. But, I'm lazy, so because it can't be anything. That's why it's easy to do physics. You simplify the problem, you get rid of all the other stuff.
You could have picked those sigma, for example, the area perhaps.
But it's the same.
Something else. It's the same because of the requirement that because you put the constraint of volume.
That's
I don't
right.
Know if that's
it's
true
same.
Or not. I mean, there's
nothing you can do to avoid that. And you don't. Of course, this doesn't tell you the number. And I'm telling you experimentally, for a pure phospholipid, it's 20 kV. I should tell you something else. I'll just tell it to you, I won't explain it to you. If you had membranes that have, say, proteins in them, like real ones do, and there are things that can move around, then it reduces this kappa. This kappa, this is the highest kappa, it reduces it because if you have something in there and you bend it, this guy that you have there might prefer being where the bend is or being away from the bend. And by moving it, the result is just like a fluctuation correction. It always reduces the bending constant. So actually, what you can prove is of the order of this, and it has to be greater than or equal to kT. It has to be bigger than kT, because otherwise it's unstable. When you have mixtures. But it's just the same argument. I'm not telling you anything where I haven't told you this stuff about it. Now, the important thing that I want to talk a little bit is about membrane fluctuations, because the membranes are not flat, and they're not flat because the bending constants are of order kT. So that means there are strong thermal fluctuations. As I said, if you made membranes out of high molecular weight polymers, the bending constants may be 1,000 or 1,000,000 kT, depending on how long they were, and then you wouldn't have very big fluctuations. But if the bending constant is of order kT, you're going to have fluctuations. So what are these fluctuations? And that's what this kind of Hamiltonian is for. Okay, so the guy who really understood that these fluctuations can be important was Wolfgang Helfrich, who's he's just retired, 5 years ago, and he's a professor in Berlin. By the way, this is the same guy who also invented how your liquid crystal display works. So he's a very, very, very great scientist. He was a great scientist and he never became a professor, a C4. How's that? Huh? But anyway, so he understood that fluctuations are important. And so, and the way, easy way to discuss, so let's look at that. So let's, here's my membrane, like that, and I draw it not straight because I want to look at the fluctuations. And in fact, I'll draw it more with me. I'll draw it like this. Here's my membrane. And this is kind of my reference membrane. So I'm going to look at membranes here, and I'll describe them. I'm going to assume something bad, which you'll see is not good, like I assumed this morning, earlier in the afternoon wasn't good. In field theory, I'm going to assume what's called the Monge gauge. I'm going to describe this membrane by a function I call H height, which is a function of x and y. In other words, I have x and y in this reference plane. At every point, I'm going to say I. That's called the Monge gauge, and it's not an exact thing to do because then I'm in trouble if I have overhangs. Then I have multi-valued functions, and then I'm lost. Okay. So this is only good if the fluctuations are small. This is only a useful thing. Well, let's assume the fluctuations are small. So then how do I get... Imagine the function. So let's be very simplistic about it. The free energy that I have here, remember I already told you I don't need this term. H is the square of the curvature. In this gauge, H is just del squared of A. I have a problem with it. Okay. Okay.
Z.
Yeah, Z.
You want to call it Z? Oh, I can't call it Y either. Sorry. Okay. So that means there's free energy there. The free energy is essentially kappa. I'll forget the factors of Ku too, because I'm del squared z squared integrated over the area of the surface area of the membrane. Right? So let's see how big these fluctuations are. So the easiest thing to do is to Fourier transform. And if you see this, before you write that in Z of X and Y goes as e to the I Q dot R, X and Y, this Fourier transform. And then this thing becomes kappa, del squared gives Q squared, I square it, I get Q to the fourth, Z. Whatever is some amplitude here, square. Okay, that's what it looks like. And that's the free energy per unit area, I'll call it a little F. That's the free energy per unit area of a mode of wave vector Q. Yep.
Cool. I have a question. In lambda Lipschitz theory of elasticity.
This is not elasticity, this is curvature elasticity.
Yeah, but they obtained the same formula for free energy of bent membrane, and they got two terms, and the first term is equal to the term that you wrote, and the second term is zero only if it was in ratio on half. So
yeah, but the first term is one has to do with surface tension, which is zero here. There is no surface tension.
Okay.
Right, that's the whole point. There's no surface tension. This is my free energy. Okay, so this is the free energy of a mode of wave vector Q. It's quadratic in the amplitude. Therefore, we immediately apply the equipartition theory. you get KT per degree of freedom, you know, the usual thing for, and it says that the average Z zero squared average, or Z squared average, is Z zero, is KT over kappa Q to the fourth. Something is wrong here.
There's one more L squared in the denominator which comes from like integrating.
Hang on, yeah, you're right, there's something that I left out. This is
average over Q.
Excuse me. This is the Fourier component. Yeah, you're right. This is the Fourier component. This is the amplitude of the thermal amplitude of a fluctuation mode of wave vector Q. This is just equipartition theory. Whenever you have an energy that's quadratic, we know that. You know, it takes 2 seconds to prove that. Maybe it isn't two. Okay, so that's the amplitude. And notice there's a problem here. When Q goes to zero, the amplitude diverges. And I've assumed that the amplitude is small. So that means this is not always a good approximation. It's only good approximation for sufficiently large Q. Okay?
Large Q or small Q?
Large Q. Small Q is better. It's when it becomes large. And we've assumed it's small when we use the moment gauge. Okay. But we'll ignore that. So what this is telling you is that there are large fluctuations, and that the smaller the wavelength, small Q, it means long wave, the longer the wavelength, the bigger the fluctuation.
No, hang on, I mean, this is the Fourier mode.
This is the Fourier mode. To get the real amplitude, I have to Fourier transform back.
Yes, and then the one over Q4 back.
Yeah, so I'm not going to get it. So this is okay, yeah. Then I get it because of the area. You'll see it in a minute. This is perfectly fine. But long wavelength mode means Q small, have large amplitude. Short wavelength modes have small amplitude. Notice the prefactor is T over kappa. T over kappa is of the order of unity. Kappa is larger than T, but it's not a billion times larger. Now, so this picture of a flat membrane is not a good picture. Now, by the way, and when you have things in it, kappa gets smaller, so the fluctuations get larger. So we have these large wiggling around due to the motion, okay, which is described here. Now, what Helfrich pointed out to us is something that's very interesting.
If the energy goes as Q to the fourth, that means the system favors low Qs, not high Qs, low Qs.
It favors low Qs, yeah.
Favors low Qs, which is long wavelength, which means flat membranes.
Yeah, but the long wavelength fluctuations. So it's cheaper to make a long wavelength fluctuation than a short wavelength. That's right, the ground state is still a flat membrane. Okay. Who knows how to do that? The ground state is still a flat membrane, but the fluctuations are favorable. Now, what Helfrich pointed out is the following thing. Suppose I have these membranes very often, if you make them in a test tube, you take phospholipids, put them in a test tube, and if you do it the right way, they form a stack. Membrane, water, membrane. Okay, they form this is called a lamellar phase. Okay. If these membranes are fluctuating, they run into the next guy. In other words, this membrane, the fluctuations in this membrane are going to bump into the next membrane, and of course, vice versa. So Helfrich said that's going to give rise to a pressure. And that pressure, we will call the Helfrich interaction. And that pressure is very important, okay. And the way to get it, well, since we don't have a lot of time to work it out, I'll do it in my simple way. I'll say that there's a certain free energy associated with these functional groups. So imagine I have this stack of lamellae. I mean, these things are pushing, and there's a certain separation here. I need another length. Let me call it L. Okay. And so I want to find out how the pressure due to these fluctuations depends upon L, depends on the periodicity of the stack. Oh, in my notes I called it D, so let's call it D.
Excuse me, can I ask why suddenly we change from this one to a stack of membrane?
Just because I wanted to show you this force. We never see one membrane. I mean, we always have one.
Or a single cell, I guess, you know.
But there's lots of things in the membrane, and cells interact with one another. There are cell, you know, cells don't occur, a cell here and a cell there.
I'm just thinking about this idealistic, you know, stack of membranes.
Okay, a cell doesn't have a stack of membrane, but when you have two cells pushing against one another, that's like a part of the stack. Yeah, but you're not thinking like a physicist. You must not be a physicist.
I'm not.
Yeah, because all you have to do with these, remember what the aspect ratio here, these things are essentially flat when they're touching.
Yeah, but I mean, I can have two touching, but if I have three, then the other must be vertical.
Let me show you this, and then it's easy to extrapolate. If I can understand this, I could do yours in 2 seconds. You don't start with the hardest problem. You start with the easiest problem. Unless you're a mathematician, start with the hardest problem.
A good mathematician starts with the easiest.
You always want to simplify. Sometimes you're throwing out the baby with the bathwater, but you learn that. But you do the simplest problem that has the physics that you think is right. Otherwise, you're asking for big trouble, I guarantee you. So, what do we do? Oh, so I want to describe the free energy of this guy in the stack, and then we could generalize anything else. So I want to write down this free energy associated with the fluctuations. I'm now, my zero of energy is what I called that zero before. Okay. So this it's a fluctuation. So again, the energy scale is kT. I know that. And then what matters. So here's this height that I was calling z over there. So this free energy has to depend on how big these fluctuations are. So it should be some function, I'll call it psi, of something like z squared average, whatever the average value of z squared is, divided by other length scale parameter. It has to be a dimensionless function. The free energy has to be a function of that. Can't be anything else. You know. Now, the other thing we know is that this free energy better be extensive. In other words, if I double the area of the membrane, I ought to get double the free energy. Okay. So the free energy should be proportional to S. Total area. Now. I didn't calculate z squared average, okay. So z squared average is the integral of what zq squared, what is it? T over kappa q fourth q to q. This is integrated over here. I mean, that's where it's at the amplitude for the qth mode, I sum up all the modes, okay? Well, this goes as one integral of, so t over the integral of 1 over q cubed, I could do that as 1 over q squared to within factors of unity. So it diverges at q equals 0. In other words, it depends on the area of the membrane. Okay? That's the cutoff. The infrared cutoff is the total area of the membrane. So the mean square amplitude of a fluctuation goes this energy parameter times the area of the membrane. Again, to within factors of two. This z squared is proportional to s. So the only, and d is just d. So the only way we could get a free energy proportional to s is if this psi is just a linear function. So therefore, this is of the order t squared over kappa s over t squared. In other words, it says that these membranes repel each other with an interaction that goes over 1 over d squared. This is what's called the Helfrich interaction. So it's just like an ideal gas repulsion. In fact, you could think of it as an ideal gas repulsion.
Can I just ask a question?
Yeah, sure.
If you were to take two plates that had a viscous fluid in between, and you start to squeeze down on it, the constant force, you discover that the force generated goes as 1 over d4.
That's right.
So this is some strange, it's not a fluid that's being modeled at all.
Yeah, but there's no dynamics in here. These are static fluctuations. So don't think of it as dynamic. These are static fluctuations. You're right. You squeeze out this. It's a different situation. These are just static fluctuations. So they're very slow. Now, nevertheless, there's a point in what you said, and that's the following. That these membranes, are sheets, and there's other interactions between them. You heard a lot about Van der Waals interaction. Any sheets, even no matter what they are, have a van der Waals attraction. And when two sheets get very close together, what is a van der Waals attraction? Well, van der Waals is of the order of a Haumacher constant, its attraction, d squared. It's d to the fourth when they're far apart, but when they're close together, it's d squared. So this is the Haumacher constant. This has nothing to do with these parameters. So this is, so which one is bigger depends on whether t squared over kappa is bigger or smaller than a. T squared over kappa greater than a means that the repulsions win. If t squared over kappa is less than a, then the membranes don't actually push apart, they screw together. That's called the unbinding transition. People like Lepofsky have done that in a very fancy way, but that's it, that's all there is. The rest of it is details about critical phenomena and stuff,
but
which is
another
kind of bullshit. Huh? It's all wrong anyway. Huh?
There's another term on the van der Waals besides attractive, there's also the repulsive.
No, well, if they're identical stuff, there's only attraction. If both things are purely identical, is only attractive piece.
Okay.
For everything identical, yeah.
Okay.
So this is the worst case.
Okay.
Now, the funny thing about it is that this is of order kT. And the other thing that's interesting, these Haumacher constants in the presence of water are also always of the order of kT. For actually similar reasons, because they all come back to Coulomb. So which one of these is very delicate balance. It's not clear which side of this transition you are. But in many cases, people could do Lemelar stacks, and see the repulsions swelling. And in other cases, you could change the parameters by adding salt or something like that, and change the side of this unbinding transition. The message is that these Helfrich fluctuations are very important. For example, I'll just give you one example. with, and I won't work it out, is that if you have, you're interested in cells, so if you have things like gap junctions that hold cells together, you have a cell come down, and it'll come together, and there'll be a junction there, some kind of lock and key thing that binds them. These things, it's the fact that these things bend away is completely given control by that. And furthermore, if you had another gap junction, like here, you would have this kind of a picture. And this is an unhappy situation. So in fact, what happens is that the energy that's stored in this unhappy region, where you force membranes to be together, but they really want to be apart, leads to this picture. Where the gap junctions go next to each other. And this, so there's an effective attractive force between gap junctions that comes from this Helfrich interaction. It's a fluctuate, and this is a large part of the reasons why gap junctions aggregate at contact points. I mean, and that's well known to any of the cell biologists. And that's a large part of it. So it's a large part of it comes from this interaction. Okay, now the way it, now what about the experiments? I mean, this is a whole sort of logic. So the classical experiments on this, which could, in some sense, which convinced people that that this is was right, and I'll mention it because it was done by buddies of ours. If I have it here somewhere. Yeah. Okay, so this, it was done, in, you know, a long time ago now, 1986, so 20 years ago, there was this experiment by these, mainly the main guys are these two guys, Didier Roux, maybe some of you know, he's now head of, he's a vice president of this big French glass company, Saint-Gobain. He's the head of all science at Saint-Gobain. And he was the postdoc then of Koskesh, Sira Safinia, who's now at Dartmouth for me. And they looked at just this kind of a lamellar phase that you don't like, but they did that because it's an easy thing to do. And this is an X-ray, just a pure X-ray scattering study. I mean, you see these are the lamellar peaks. That's not interesting. All the physics is in the shape of these peaks. Let's see. We'll have his name down here. In 1972, long before that, Caillé, who's a French-Canadian theorist, for lamellar phases, he wasn't even thinking about surfactants. He was thinking of lamellar phases of liquid crystals, of smectic phases, worked out what you would see in an X-ray scattering experiment. And the shape of the peaks, of those peaks that you saw, the shape of the peak was given by Q, the wave vector, to some funny exponent. That's because of two-dimensionality physics, and I don't want to bother trying to explain it. But the main thing is that this exponent here, which is in the shape of the peaks that I'll show you back again, that's in these peaks, the shapes of these kind of peaks here, how the intensity falls off with Q is directly related to the bulk modulus of the system, how easy it is to squeeze it. I mean, what a scattering experiment, as you all know, measures the osmotic compressibility of the stuff you're measuring. So it's natural that the scattering depends on how easy it is to squeeze the stuff. It's measuring the compressibility. And so it's just related to the bulk modulus. So by this, you get the bulk modulus, and by careful analysis of the shapes of these peaks, there are many peaks to analyze, of course, then they Didier and Koskesh, I guess it's in the next picture, they get a very good fit. These are the dots of the experiments, and the line was a fit using this Helfrich interaction. So this is, I think it was this experiment that was done, as I said, Exxon years ago now, that convinced people that this health-rich interaction really existed, because it was just theory until then. And of course now there's been a lot more evidence, and you don't have to worry about it. So I'm running late, so this is probably a good time to stop. So what I tried to convince you here, first, is that self-assembly is important. That don't think of it as a sheet of paper, because it's not like that. It's not elastic. Elasticity is in curvature elasticity. And these fluctuations play in a big role. Now, having said, and I'll stop, but one thing I'll just say as an addendum. In real cells, where there's a cytoskeleton, things are different. Because the cytoskeleton, this underlying spectrin or actin network, gives a real elastic component. So the systems, you should think of a membrane with a cytoskeleton. One way of doing it is like Sam Safran and Neil Gunn, people think like that, of it as a two-component system, a fluid membrane very sparsely coupled to an elastic network. And so there's elasticity here, and curvature only elasticity here, and so people nowadays are studying these couple problems to understand the nature of something that's closer to biology than the permanent, something like the cytoskeleton. Okay, so what I again tried to give you was again a kind of a primer on the underlying physics of membranes. So you think about them in the right way. Okay, so thanks.